This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, people that are sent to prison are supposed to be given back their freedom when they've served their time. But that doesn't seem to apply to Black political prisoners, many of whom are now elderly and sick, but the state wants them to die in prison. We'll have a report from Kyle Frazier.
But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held a two-day school on electoral politics earlier this month in St. Petersburg, Florida. One of those on hand was Charles Barron, a former member of the Black Panther Party, who was elected to the New York City Council and then to the state legislature. Assemblyman Barron says there's no contradiction between his Black Panther politics and running for office.
I wanted to let you know why I wanted to run for office in the first place. You know, coming out of the Black Panther Party, it wasn't the most strangest thing, because Bobby Seale in 1973 did run for mayor of Oakland and did well. Shocked a lot of people. Elaine Brown, she ran for city council, got 35,000 votes. And Bobby ran for mayor, got 43% of the vote. And it's always a debate, and I'm sure we're going to do it in our school, whether you do an independent party line or whether you do the Democratic Party primary strategy. I say do both. Do both. And you can do both. Technically, I did both. I ran for governor, as the brother mentioned, because we wanted to put the Freedom Party on the map. I ran for governor. You had to get 15,000 signatures to get on the ballot, and they make it so difficult that you have to get 100 signatures in 15 different congressional districts. So you can't just go to one spot where you got all your support and get the 15,000 signatures. So they thought we didn't know that, so we wound up with 26 congressional districts where we got over 300 signatures, and instead of 15,000 signatures, we submitted 45,000 signatures. 45,000. So we got on the ballot. Then they said that we weren't going to be a part of the debates because we weren't a major party. So it was Cuomo and Paladino. We fought that, got into the debates. And I said, I know I'm going to rock him in the debates. I couldn't wait. But then here came this brother. We couldn't knock him off the ballot because I was saying that all of the New York State slate was white. So this brother rent too damn high. He started saying, rent too damn high. Boy, that took off, Chairman. And then he came in with black gloves and to the debate. I said, Lord have mercy. I don't stand a chance. Here I am knocking him out. I'm beating up Cuomo on the stage and everything. And I see on the front page of every paper, rent too damn high with his black gloves. I said, I'll be damned. He went and got 45,000 votes. I got 25,000. This man was like, not well. Got 45,000 votes. I'm breaking it down, you know, getting intellectual and deep. And I come out with 25,000. But, you know, you don't, when you're doing a third party, you know, you need 50,000 votes to become a state-recognized party. But I think we get too caught up in that. The state don't have to recognize you. You can't count on your oppressors to recognize you. And when they don't recognize you, you say you don't have a party. I said, you know, as soon as we get started, we have a party. I don't care if I get one vote. We got people. We got a platform. We have a party. But the internal contradictions in our movement, that party is at a standstill now. But let me get why I chose the Democratic primary as a strategy, as a tactic. 90% of our people are Democrats. When they go to the general election, they don't even look at your name. They just say Democrat. Now, in the Democratic primary, everybody's a Democrat. And they still ask you, you a Democrat? Yeah, me and everybody else. Brother, you better ask what's our position on some stuff. They don't even ask you your position. You a Democrat? So, yeah, brother, me, him, her, everybody in the Democratic primary is a Democrat, bro. You got to ask another question. But I noticed that in Black and Latino communities across the country, it ain't about Trump, it ain't about the Tea Party, it ain't about white politicians. It is the Black neo-colonial Democratic puppets that the Democratic Party makes sure they have resources, make sure that they have a way to get on the ballot, and they put them in prime positions so that they can control the economy and the politics of Black communities. So if we're talking about self-determination, it has to start in that political arena, adjoined with everything else. So I said, you know what I'm gonna do? I said, hey, y'all, let's just register as Democrats. To hell with the Democratic Party. We don't go to their meetings. They don't do no fundraisers for us. You know, they tried to get me after I beat them, and I'll show you how we did that. Then they said, Councilman, would you like us to help you get on the ballot? We'll do your petitions. You don't even have to go out. And I said, no, sir. Councilman, we want to do a fundraiser for you. We can raise $20,000 for you. No, sir. And I'm broke. And I still said, no, sir. They said, well, don't you need money? Got it. I ain't had a penny. And then I said, money doesn't vote, people vote. And I said, yeah, we need some money to get the people to vote now. But I talked my stuff anyway. So when I first ran, people said, don't tell everybody you was a Black Panther. You know, after you get elected, after you get in, then tell them you was in the party, because then it'll be too late. I said, hey, y'all, first of all, I may not be your best candidate. I could win. I'm going to win that seat. But I don't know if I am your best candidate. That's the first thing y'all got to do, get the right candidate. You know, you're going to talk about the strategies and tactics and all of that. You're going to entrust that in a candidate. I told them that I will never, ever be a politician. So don't think, after I get in, don't say, could you talk to the mayor so I can get a job? I'm not doing it. You know, we need our program funded. You know, we're with them. I helped you get elected. So I said, I'm not going to be in it. I'm going to get you some money. I'm going to get you some jobs. I'm going to fund your program. That's not why I'm in it. We use the electoral process because our people are in pain. Our people are in pain. Huey Newton always taught us in the Black Panther Party, survival programs pending the revolution. So there's certain things you got to do. You can't go out there talking a lot of rhetoric to our people and you're not putting nothing on the table. You can't deliver no jobs. You can't stop the community from being gentrified. You can't do any of that. But our rhetoric, our ideology is correct. But people, like Amilcar Cabral said, bear in mind, the people are not fighting for ideas in your head. They're fighting for material benefits and a future for their children. So when I ran, I was running against people and they were saying, Charles, we love you. But look at all of the programs that the incumbent funded. You know, they give them thousands. And I said, wait. That is not an accomplishment. That is a requirement of the job. Anybody in office could do that. Tell him or her to show you something they did beyond the requirement. That's a requirement. So if you run, they're going to say, I want to vote for you, but they funded my program. They got my baby in school. Because that's what neoliberalism does. They give them resources. I had to go up against that. Then I didn't have any money. So I raised around $20,000, but in New York they had a matching fund. So for every dollar you raise, they give you two. So I had about $40,000, $50,000. My opponent had like hundreds of thousands and giving out stuff. So I broke my butt. I mean, I was at every train station, door to door, wins the war. I knocked on every door. I knocked on every door. Then I start picking off the people that they were counting on. I have a lot of public housing in my district. Tenant association leaders. I got with the, I said, I know you're down with the folk, but they don't really do anything. I won over half of their tenant leaders. Then I went to the block association presidents. So if you have public housing or if you have homes, there's going to be block associations and there's going to be tenant leaders. Won them over. I got one or two clergy that got down with me. But the most we did was we built a grassroots movement. We got to the people. And I know they never are out there. See, you got to be a community organizer. You got to organize the people. So every major issue that came by, they wanted to build an environmentally hazardous incinerator in East New York. I organized the community, and we stopped it. And they were shocked. They wanted to take out the fire alarm boxes in East New York, saying too many false alarms, to put in paid, you have to have a quarter to put in to say, you got change, there's a fire, you know, to call the fire station. I stopped that. We won that. They had coal-fired furnaces in our public schools. Beat it back. And, of course, the police were beating us down all the time, so I was always out there organizing. Then the other thing I did, and this came easy because I was a Black Panther, and they used to say things like, I'd get on TV and they'd say, ex-Black Panther, take off the X. Take off the X. You know, I'm still a Black Panther to my heart, so take the X off. So when they realized that that was working for me, I would go into senior citizen centers. And the mother, y'all know that the Panthers fed them children some breakfast. That's right. That's right. So I used it. You know, anytime they said something, I said, Black Panther, I'm glad you mentioned it. Let me tell you what the Black Panther Party did. And I ran it all down. So everything they raised. But I started off in 2001. I got elected to the New York City Council. I had to run, it's 4-year term, so the first time I ran, people were saying, you ran the first time just to get noticed so you can win the second time. I said, no, I was running to win the first time. It just didn't happen. So the first time I ran, I didn't even know a lot about electoral politics. I didn't even know that you're supposed to meet with unions to get union support. My lawyer said, did you have your union meetings yet? I said, nobody called me for a union meeting. He said, no, Charles, you're supposed to call them. With all of that confusion, I had my little team. I said, come on, yo, we're going to learn as we go along. We was going door to door and making noise. The other thing, I had a media strategy. See, I knew I didn't have no money. And what does money buy in electoral politics? Name recognition. How do you get name recognition? Through mailings, through posters, through palm cards, and through the media. So I started all kinds of stuff in the media swamped in. Brooklyn 12 and New York 1. In New York City, it's good media to get because they loop the same story all day long. You know, if you get on Channel 4, 5, 7, I've been on them as well, but that's like 15, 30, 20 seconds at 11 o'clock, and that's it. Maybe you'll get on at 5 and 6 and be on both, but usually you're going to be on 5 or 6. You're not going to be on 11 o'clock. The president only gets 20, 30 seconds, you know, on those things. But New York 1 and Brooklyn 12, they play the same story all day long and sometimes for 2 days. So I had a strategy. I call up New York 1. I come on, y'all come on, y'all covering some stuff. That ain't no news. Look what I'm doing up here in East New York. Y'all better give me some coverage. This is racist, man. So I'm going to turn around and some white people on there. What about Black people? We're doing some. People think I got stock in Brooklyn 12 now because I'm on there regularly. I'm on a regular basis. So I got, in spite of not knowing a lot and not having a lot of money, because of my energy and my love for my people and getting out there organizing, I got 4,000 votes. They had to get the whole machine against me, the mayor, the unions. They had no unions and had no preachers, nobody. And we got 4,000. She got 6,000 to get back in, but I knew she was term limited. So I knew that 4 years from now was going to be an open seat. And because they wanted to stop me, they cleared the field. They said, nobody else run. Because if we run, you're going to split up our vote and Barron will get in. So I was the only one running. So by the time 2001 came, nobody had any name recognition but me. But I was still scared because the machine is the machine. When I say the machine, you're talking about the county boss of the Brooklyn Democratic Party. You're talking about lawyers. You're talking about all the incumbents. You're talking about preachers. You're talking about people that they're funding. That's the machine. They came at me big time in 2001. I mean, it was almost physical war. I mean, I had a Fannie Shakur, so the Tupac mom. She came and did a fundraiser for me. We had wars. My brother was saying there's 110 election districts. The machine hires all of the workers inside the districts. So when you're running, the people counting the votes and telling people how to vote are with the machine. They're hired by the machine. See, the poll workers, they're workers. They get $300 an election. That's $600 for poor people in the hood. And the Democratic Party has district leadership positions. And the district leaders hire the election day workers. So if 300 of you are getting paid by the machine to work on election day, and I say, hey, could you work with my campaign for $100? You ain't doing it. So I had to deal with that. And what we did, I said, listen, y'all, take the money and vote for me. Y'all know they ain't no good. He said, I'll do that, Mr. Barron. Nobody know how you're going to vote. Take the money and vote for me. And then the ones that's the ones inside. Then the campaign that you're running against the machine, they have 50 people on the outside with your palm cards. I had two people at each spot, and they was like, you know, Charles Barron. 20 of their people rooting, move that. You're too close to the camp. Move down a little. I said, don't y'all move. I had to run around and say, don't move nowhere. I had to fight at every polling site. I see my people like two blocks. Come back here. You don't stand here. Because they overwhelm you. So I had to make sure I drove around to every polling site, moving my people up. And they said, Charles, you're electioneering. You're not to be as a shut up. Yeah, what you say. I went inside, not supposed to be inside. Y'all cheat, I'm cheating too. I'm not going to be the only one playing by the rules. And y'all out here breaking all the rules. So I said, take me to court. Call the cops. Because what y'all doing is wrong. And you intimidate my workers. I went crazy. Finally, at the end of the night, this is for the second time. The first time we looked at the computer, it's really disheartening. You have your whole campaign. Election District 80, Barron 25, Wooten 300. Lord have mercy. And you have to go through each one. But that second time was sweet. Barron 80, Jackson 70. I said, oh, we're close. And I said, it kept coming. At the end of the day, I was up by 300 votes. Then you had to go to the, because they're going to count the paper ballots. And they're going to cheat there, too. I said, let's get down to the board of election. We got this. I told the whole campaign, I don't care what you're doing tomorrow. We're going to the board of elections. When they count that paper, we're going to be sitting right there. Let me see that paper. What's that one say? You know, when it finished, I won by 267 votes. 267 votes. And let me tell you what the reason why I chose to run for city council, and I hope we go through this when we have our school. The city council has the power to determine what's going to be built on city-owned land. Any city-owned land in your district, and most city councils across the country, they vote to see what's going to be built on city-owned land. City council, they have the power to determine what's going to be built on city-owned land. If Donald Trump came to my beloved East New York and said he wanted to build Trump Towers on city-owned land on Blake Avenue, he has to see the Black Panther. Even if he had $1 trillion, he doesn't have the power, and the mayor doesn't have the power to give him the land. It's the city council. The only way he gets over on me, if the city council members don't vote with me, then he's over. But traditionally, any city council member that says no, the entire council is going to support it in their district. That's just a tradition. So I knew that. The city council passes laws, not the mayor. The mayor can't pass a law. He has to get a council member to sponsor his bills. The city council passes the budget. We have an $80 billion budget that the city council passes. The budget is not passed by the mayor. He presents it. Just like the budget is not passed by the president, he presents it to Congress. The budget is not passed by the governor. He presents it to the state assembly, or she. So we have to understand where the power is. It's all about power. And that's why I got in. It's about power. You have to deal with state power. If you study any revolutions across the country, across the world, the guerrilla warfare, defiance campaigns, workers' strike, but they have to deal with state power. How do you cease it or control it or make it do things that you want it to do? So we won, and this is some of the benefits of winning. The reason why East New York is not gentrified, Harlem is, Bedford-Stuyvesant is, Crown Heights is, most black communities are suffering from gentrification, but not East New York. And don't take my word for it. There's a Daily News article, and they hate me, that said East New York, Brooklyn, is the only black community in the city that has experienced a 13.2% increase in the black population. The only one in Brooklyn. And the reason being, the reason they gave, because of affordable housing. And let me tell you how you make a housing really affordable. See, everybody says affordable housing. Affordable to who? And who's going to define affordability? Whenever y'all get in office, always look up the AMI, the area median income. The area median income. A developer came to my office when I first got in. I did my research. I did my homework. He said, Councilman, we're going to build affordable housing in East New York. And I'm going to put my application in, so HPD, the Housing Preservation Development Company of the Agency of the City, and I'm going to build you 172 units of affordable housing. He took out his portfolio. The housing looked beautiful. He wanted to do a PowerPoint. I said, put everything away. What is the required income? And he thought, he didn't know I did my research. He said, HUD has defined affordability as 80% of New York City's AMI. HUD defines affordability as 80% of New York's AMI. So now, you as an elected official, you got to know what New York's AMI is. New York City's AMI or the New York metropolitan area, here's how they trick you. If they do New York City, that's the five boroughs. If they use the New York metropolitan area, that's Westchester County, that's, you know, Suffolk County, that's the suburbs right outside of New York. So I know that the AMI of New York metropolitan area that they use is $84,000 for a family of three. And I know that 80% of that is $64,000 for a family of three. So I said, sir, did you know that? He said, yes. So I said, well, do you know my neighborhood AMI? He said, no. I said, you just insulted my intelligence. You came in my office and said you were going to build affordable housing, and you don't even know the AMI of my neighborhood. This meeting is terminated. I really did. I sent him away. I said, you do your homework. He said, I didn't mean to insult you. Well, you did. Go do your homework, and I'll see you in another 2-3 weeks. He came back 2 weeks later. Now, Councilman, I'm so sorry. What's my neighborhood income? $34,000 for a family of three. $34,000, right? So you doubled my neighborhood area median income. You doubled it, and then you called it affordability. Now, let me tell you what's going to happen, or else I'm not signing off. So he left. He came back. I said, this is what's going to happen, and this is how I kept East New York not gentrified. I said, you're going to develop housing according to the income band of my community, the income band. 52% of the people in my community make $35,000 or less. So you're going to have 50% of the housing at 35 and under. 30% of the people in my community make $35,000 to $60,000. You're going to have 30% of the housing at $35,000, and there are some of us that make $60,000, $70,000 to $100,000. That is 20%. So only 20% is going to be at that range. Nobody making over $50,000, because I was trying to keep, not prejudice, I was trying to keep white folk out. Not y'all. Y'all could have moved in. We didn't mind y'all. But the other ones. I was trying to keep white folk out, stop being gentrified. I know not too many white people make $50,000 or less. So my community wasn't gentrified because of that, because we said 50 and below. But what I did start doing now, for those anybody making 60, 70, 80,000, is hurting. They're hurting because, you know, that they can't get Medicaid. They can't get the breaks that, you know, the poor people get. They can't get in housing because of people like me, you know. So, but they are hurting. So now I try to look out for the 15, 20%. But with their funding program in the state now, that's why I didn't vote for it, 80-20, 80% market and 20% affordability. And the 20% affordability is 80% of the AMI. That's the 421A program that they're passing as we speak. They're passing it right now in the state. And that's what I had to block.
That was New York State Assemblyman Charles Barron speaking to the Black is Back Coalition in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Cam Howard also spoke to the coalition's Electoral Politics School. Howard is part of the leadership of INCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, as well as a member of the Black is Back Coalition's Executive Board. Last year, Black is Back approved a 19-point national black political agenda for self-determination. At the St. Petersburg School, Cam Howard argued that skillful use of voter initiatives and referendums is a good way to push for reparations and black community control of the police and other issues on the agenda for black self-determination. Referendums could also be useful in challenging the legitimacy of those sellouts in the black misleadership class.
Do we actually have legitimate black representation in the political field, in the political arena? And we can say, I can say categorically that Charles Barron is an anomaly. Yes. He is not what we have in leadership in the political arena. The most well-known slogan that we know, when there was a question of whether or not there was legitimate representation, was this whole piece in America called Taxation Without Representation. So they were having a conversation about, you got people in England telling us over here what we have to do, how we have to live, how we have to be organized, how much money we have to pay to do this. They're not our representatives. So we're being taxed and other things without true representation. So that representation in England is illegitimate. And so we have to ask the same question today, is do we have legitimate African representation? And the ballot initiative was designed to address that whole issue of legitimacy. What I think legitimate African representation is direct, meaning that you have direct access to your so-called political leader. It is complete. This 19-point agenda is a complete agenda. It doesn't say, okay, I'm down with this, but I'm not down with that. You know, it's a complete representation. It is unwavering, as Brother Charles Barron, no matter where he goes, he's going to talk about colonialism and imperialism and capitalism, and he's unwavering in that. And so we have to be clear that our leadership is unwavering on the issue of subjugation and overturning the subjugation of African people. We are clear that we exist in America and on the planet right now as a subjugated people, and that there is an entity that's doing the subjugation, and we know who that entity is, and we know we have to overturn or address that entity to remove that subjugation. We got to be unwavering on that particular fact. And our leadership has to be unwavering. It has to be honest, and it has to be a true representation of our people's interests. And we say utilizing the African principle of the greatest good for the greatest number of African people, not just a particular faction of African people. Like when Barack Obama, who's been anointed this great black leader, he only talked about the black middle class or the middle class. Never talked about the poor. He went with that Reagan piece that a rising tide lift all boats, you know, and that was supposed to address the 50% of African men who were out of the labor force in every major city in America. Never addressed the question of that 50% of African men. And so it wasn't the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And we can look at all of our leadership and we can see that they represent a particular class of black leadership, but more so than that, they represent a particular class of white leadership. So our position in this country in connection to our leadership is a colonial, neocolonial relationship. And so we say colonialism began with Christopher Columbus. And Christopher Columbus, Dr. John Henry Clark, his name was mentioned a second ago, tell us that Christopher Columbus was a con man. And one of his names was Cristobal Colon. Isn't that right, Sherman? And that's where you get the term colonialism from, or colony, from this system that was created by Cristobal Colon, who we know as Christopher Columbus. There was no colonialism before Cristobal Colon. And that system was where all of the economic factors, all of the political structures, all of the social structures in a particular environment where it benefited this foreign entity that you had a relationship to. So when you look at our community and you see that the politics in our community, the economics in our community, the social institutions in our community are ordered in a way that doesn't benefit the people, but it benefits a foreign entity, the white elite, if you will. So we see that, and our brothers were very clear in the 60s that we lived in a ghetto colonial situation, because the leaders there and everything that was ordered in those communities did not benefit us. It was to benefit those who lived outside our community. And then we have neocolonialism, where you just have blackface in those positions, but it's still the same relationship where the community itself is not benefited by this particular leadership, by this economic and social structure, social organizing of this community, but the benefit is to those who live outside. So the economic reality, when we know we have the Koreans, the Chinese, the other Asians, you have the Arabs and all these other economic entities in our community, we know that that's still a colonial relationship. That is not even neocolonial. The political structure is neocolonial, but the economic structure is still colonial. The social structures, the police, is still a colonial structure. So we haven't deviated from that. But we're not calling, our leadership is not addressing these issues from that particular standpoint. So we say black leadership is non-black leadership. It is actually an illegitimate representation of our interests. And so we have colonialism, neocolonialism, bond. And how can we say that black leadership is non-black leadership? One definition of legitimate is being exactly as proposed, neither spurious or false, neither deceitful or non-genuine. So we can't say that black leadership is being exactly as proposed to represent the will of all the people. So when we put a person in office, they're supposed to represent the will of that community. And that's not happening. So we can't say that that leadership is legitimate. It is an illegitimate leadership. And I thank Brother Glenn Ford for sharing with us how Malcolm was the first to begin to criticize black leadership. We have to be able to criticize black leadership in a different way today. And I think if we develop something around this whole notion of illegitimacy, they have an illegitimate relationship to the African people who they're supposed to represent. He called them handkerchief head Negroes. Now, we got to call them something, but we might want to go back to that. But we have to begin to address the notion that we have an illegitimate class of people who are non-representing us and proposing that they do. Right on. this whole issue of a colorblind constitution, and I think you talked about that, Brother Barron, in one of your statements, that you can't say black because you're going to have to run up against the Constitution, because the Constitution is supposed to be colorblind. So here it is, you are cutting us off from even saying that we're going to leave black people by this whole notion of this colorblind constitution. And so you have to reduce non-race-based legislation. You got to say, this is for minorities. Isn't that right? And then you have black leaders in Chicago. We had some brothers who was like, you're going to say black today with the black. They don't even say black. And so we're going to make you say black today, right? They'll say minority. They'll say other. And if they say black, they got to put and brown with it. Say black and brown. You know, they won't say just black. And so if you are supposed to represent us and you can't even say us, then that's illegitimate leadership. There's no legitimacy there. We don't have a legitimate relationship. We had this one councilman who spent 8 years fighting to get a Walmart on the south side of Chicago. They had this law where any big box store, your employment had to be full-time and had to be above minimum wage in order for a big box to come into the city. And so Walmart didn't have full-time wages. And so this Negro spent 8 years fighting to get this Walmart in, and he got these 300 jobs, but Walmart pulls resources out of our community at a hypersteroid rate. So here's another relationship where you bring in this colonial enterprise that snatches all the resources out of our community. The brother talked about this casino, $141 million a month, snatched out our community. That's an economic colonial relationship. And so this Negro is fighting for this colonial relationship with Walmart instead of fighting to have an economic development fund, yeah, as Brother Charles Brown was saying, that we could have built 300 businesses, not just had 300 jobs. Yeah. We could have built 300 businesses. So this shows the illegitimacy of black leadership. So the ballot initiative is a means by which a petition signed by a certain minimum number of registered voters can bring about a public vote on proposed statute. So this is a way that we bypass. An initiative is a way that you bypass the legislators. You bypass this illegitimate leadership. You're taking a vote directly to the people. We have a representative form of government. So the representative we put in place is supposed to craft legislation in our interest. Well, if they're not doing that, then what is a means of us doing it ourselves? And that is what the initiative process allows us to do. It's not only questioning, because we know this leadership is illegitimate. How do we bypass this leadership? And so the initiative is one way. There's 24 states who allow for ballot of initiatives, which are a form of what is called direct democracy, that the people actually themselves vote on law with the initiative. Referendums. So we talk about ballot measures. We're talking about either referendums, initiatives, or propositions. They're all the same. But it's where we put, or we get something put on the ballot that has a direct relationship to a particular law that we are trying to get passed. So the difference between a referendum is that the referendum allows the people to state their opinion on laws that have not been enacted by the legislature, that have either been proposed, have been voted on, but have not been enacted. And the initiative allows the people to propose their own laws. So those are that's the major difference between the referendum and the initiative. And so what we would like to do is be in initiative states or in initiative cities where we can craft our own question and our own laws, completely bypassing this illegitimate leadership, that we don't have a relationship with the black people in these city chambers or these state chambers who are supposed to represent us. We don't have a direct, complete, unwavering relationship, a genuine, non-deceitful relationship with these people. And so this is a means by which we can address that.
That was Cam Howard speaking to the Black is Back Coalition.
Prison abolitionists from across the country are gearing up for a Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March in Washington on August 19th. But for right now, Ann Lamb, co-chair of the Jericho Movement in New York City, is focused on freeing political prisoner Jahlil Muntakim. He's the former Black Liberation Army member, once known as Anthony Bottoms, now serving his 46 years behind bars. Ann Lamb spoke with Black Agenda Report producer Kyle Frazier. She said the state wants Munta Kim to die in prison.
Jaleel's been turned down for parole 9 times. Harmon's been turned down for parole a bunch of times. So it's very clear, you know, they want to impose something which is not legal. They want to impose life without parole on all our political prisoners. And I think Jaleel is a really good prime example of how afraid they are of the ideas about political prisoners. That is what the state is afraid of. They make it clear, you know, why is Jaleel where he is? Why was he put in SHU? It wasn't because he was doing what they said. It was because he was imparting some very important historical information to young people who were responding to that and who were trying to, you know, put it into the context of their own lives. So, you know, that's something that's hard enough to do out here in minimum security. Put yourself in maximum security and be doing that. Very difficult. One of the reasons I love Jaleel so much is because he, like Mumia, you know, he insists and persists in doing what he's doing. He's been behind the walls for a long time. He has not changed his mind about what he thinks could be a better world. He has not changed his mind about educating other people. You know, he's one of the people that, you know, Che talks about, true revolutionaries are guided by great feelings of love. Yes, they are. And his love for his people and his love for his community has remained steadfast. And I think that is a lot of what our great freedom fighters and revolutionaries are all about. And we don't talk about that so much sometimes, but it's very important because that is the motivating factor. The motivating factor is love for your community. So if you love your community and you consider your community like your family, you would do anything to defend your community. And that is an absolute God-given right, the right of self-defense and the right to defend your family. Nobody can take that away from us. No law that can say that you can't do this, you can't do that matters, because there are some things that are more important than what the law says.
You visited with Brother Jaleel recently since his most recent transfer, after being transferred from Attica to Southport Correctional Facility and then to Shawangunk. How was that visit? What is his current status with respect to these recent moves and punitive actions?
You know, the SHU is hard, but he took advantage of it by writing several wonderful pieces. The Cognitive Dissonance, which I urge everybody to read. He also wrote a poem for the annual dinner for the political prisoners, which is also up there in his poetry. Excellent poem. He also wrote an entire, very long, detailed letter to Governor Cuomo about two things. One was the attempt to restrict the visits. And also he has an entire plan to expand the work release program. Back in the day when Cuomo's dad was governor, the work release program was much more extensive than it is now. It was available to all prisoners. Then the laws changed and became more repressive, as we have seen in many cases. So he wrote this all very detailed and very excellent suggestion to the governor about expanding that. Now, whether he'll hear back from the governor or not, we don't know. But it was certainly a wonderful piece.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has been in the news quite a bit lately with regard to New York State prisons, not only due to the proposed changes to the visits, but also regarding questions of packages. Could you discuss those two issues and the status of those issues at present?
Okay, well, the visitation is clearly a loss for the governor and a win for the people who visit. That has been, you know, taken out of the budget, that restriction of the visits. The thing about the packages is very concerning. They already have a new directive out, 4911A, about this. They are trying to make it be that people can no longer bring to their loved ones and things that they like to eat, all right, or some clothes, right? Like, you know, if it's cold, they're allowed to have, like, you know, some thermals or a sweater, a blanket. You know, there's very restricted in terms of what color they can be and so on and so forth. It's already very restrictive what you can bring in and what you can't. But now they want to do away with that entirely, and they want to have everybody have to order stuff through DOCS-approved vendors. That's going to it's going to do a couple of things. It's going to probably increase the cost of things. It's going to take away just a small human pleasure that, you know, it gives me pleasure, like, to go and bring him a food package, and he could say, oh, I'd like to have this, 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 and this, and we'll see what we can find. And the excuse is, the excuse by the seals is, so much contraband comes in through these packages. And those of us who bring packages, those of us who visit our loved ones, you know, I travel with many women who are going to see social prisoners. We're all in the same boat. We all experience the same things. So the women were saying two things about this. One, oh, well, they want all the money to go to them, which is true. And B, they want to take away our small pleasure of being able to bring our loved ones something that we know they like to have. And everybody said, and who brings in the contraband? The CEOs bring in the contraband. They make money on it. And that has been going on for a long time. It's been known, CEOs selling cell phones, selling drugs. So they make their little money that way. And, you know, all of that stuff is so well inspected, it would be very difficult for anybody to sneak in any contraband. They're going to start out and do it at certain hubs and see how it goes. And then if it works well, then they'll implement it system-wide. It's like the thing with the pictures. You know, with certain facilities now, they're taking our pictures. They're doing it at Sullivan. They're doing it at Shawangunk. I heard they're now doing it at Attica. They weren't doing it the last time I was there. But interestingly, one of the CEOs at Shawangunk said to one of the women, she smiled. Now, they don't like you to smile. You know, we usually don't smile when they take our pictures anyway. But this one woman had this beautiful smile. And they said, the CEO said to her, oh, don't smile. It ruins the facial recognition. Okay, so they are not just saying they're taking our pictures, which is what it says in the directive. No, they're using facial recognition software on people who come to visit the prisoners.
How are your visits to political prisoners more generally?
Well, visits to political prisoners generally are, to me, a wonderful thing. They have a lot that they can teach us, and we have a lot we can learn from them. And it's mutual. They also learn from us. You know, what's going on out here? What's the situation really like now? You know, all these kinds of things. We'll have very long political, philosophical discussions. When I met Mumia, I only got to see Mumia once back in 2009 when he was still on death row. Went to see him at FCI Green, finally got on the list, got permission. That was an amazing visit. We had such a great philosophical discussion that I had no idea that it was already 3:30 and the CEO came over and said, you know, you have to leave. I said, 3 o'clock already? He said, no, actually it's 3:30. You know, that shows the respect the CEOs had at FCI Green for Mumia. You know, that they would let visitors stay late like that. And, you know, it was just a tremendous conversation. We talked about everything. We talked about the illusion that this system is, you know, unbeatable, indestructible. We know that that's not true. And, but, you know, and all the ways they convince people to feel powerless. We have the same kind of discussion with Jalil. You have the same kind of discussion with Robert Zepes. You can have the same kind of discussion with Herman Bell. You can certainly have the same kind of discussion with the MOVE women, who I've also had the honor and privilege to meet. And any one of our political prisoners. It's a little harder to visit people in the feds because we're supposed to have maybe known them before. Right? That makes it a little difficult. But there are ways around that. I think everybody should, you know, take the time, especially in the state of New York. It's very easy for us to visit our prisoners. We only have to have a New York State ID with our picture. We don't have to be on a list, as you do have to be in Pennsylvania. We don't have to be on, you know, we don't have any particular restrictions. You know, we don't have to be family. We can go. Anybody can go and visit and say that you're their friend. Now, obviously, if they're using facial recognition software, some people might have to think twice about visiting. So that's for those people who would be worried about that. Then they can say, well, maybe I shouldn't go. You know, that's fine. You can still write. You can still have an exchange of ideas through letters, which are very important. It really keeps your spirits up. You know, people are out there and they care about you and they're working to try to get you out. That really helps a lot.
We know that a major action is occurring this year around prisoner human rights in August. Is Jericho a part of the organizing efforts for this action? And what do you expect to come out of August's human rights action?
We're definitely part of this. We actually first learned it through Jalil. They had been in touch with him. And he said, oh, we get in touch with these folks. I said, oh, absolutely. Yes, we're definitely supporting it. You know, we've told all our chapters. Everybody knows about it. We're very excited by it. We think it's very important. And it is a huge issue. And since we're living in this state of mass incarceration, if only the family members of everybody who is imprisoned in this country came to D.C., it would be millions of people. It would be millions. So we know everybody can't come to D.C. You know, it's just logistically not possible. You know, say you live in San Francisco, well, you could do something out there, simultaneous, right? So we're really looking forward to it. We are helping organize around it. And we think it's extremely important. The human rights of prisoners in this country is just horrible, the situation. There's been a lot of reports just here recently about, you know, the whole violence at Rikers, which is a city jail or a city penal colony, as we would prefer to say. And, you know, that culture of violence by the COs is really, really deeply ingrained. You know, when you go up to the upstate prisons, a lot of those COs, the younger ones, they're a CO because their dad was a CO. You know, their grandpa was a CO. Their uncle was a CO. Their mom was a CO. You know, it's a little family tradition. And they're all white folk, almost exclusively, except if you go to Sing Sing. You're going to see mostly white COs. And they're, who are they, you know, who are they overseeing, or who are they the overseers of in this slaveocracy, right? And they're the overseers of mostly black and brown people. And their racism does come out at all times. So, you know, the worst thing that you could be, place you could be, would be to be in some solitary confinement, horrible place where they keep people literally for years. And it's well known that how bad this is for people. There's been tons of studies done about it. And so they continue to insist and persist on doing these things. So there you are, maybe in solitary confinement. And that's when they come to your cell, when you got nobody got your back because you're by yourself, and they could do anything to you. And they have done this to people. They have killed people. They have maimed people for life. And you don't see any of them going to prison for this. You know, it's just like out here when the cops kill people, right? Pantaleo's not sitting in prison, right? Haste is not sitting in prison. You know, total impunity. So it to me, it's like, and I've been saying this for years, this, you know, we live in a fascist country. And if you don't think that's true, go to a prison. Go to a prison. Or go sit down at 100 Center Street and watch what goes on there all day. And you will see that we live in a fascist country.
There have been regular calls to Governor Cuomo. Is that a campaign still going on?
This is an ongoing campaign. This is a social media campaign to Governor Cuomo. We do it every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. The reason that he is asking for this clemency, aside from the fact of, you know, all the stuff that he's been going through recently, is because it is obvious that it is impossible for him or any other of our political prisoners to receive any kind of fair hearing from the parole board. If you've been to the parole board 9 times and they turn you down 9 times due to, quote unquote, the nature of the crime, which they're not even supposed to be doing, but they're doing it anyway and getting away with it. And that, of course, is because they're all in cahoots, as I say, the PBA. But we're definitely doing the Twitter storm for Julio. If you don't tweet, don't worry about it. You can write a letter. You can call the governor. All the information is up on his website. It's right on the first page. You just click the link. And I would encourage everybody to do that as well, because we want to try to put some heat on Cuomo, because we say, okay, he made some concession to the community with this clemency for Judith Clark. So that is to the white community. But, you know, Julio's not asking for that kind of clemency. He's not asking, let me go to the board. He's been to the board a whole bunch of times. Julio should have been out in 2002. So that would have been his 25. And his full 25. So, you know, there's no reason for him to still be sitting in prison, except, as I always say, the state is so afraid of Jaleel's mind that they don't want to ever let him out because, you know, he might influence other people. Like, if you go read through his history, you can see that he was twice commended for stopping riots in 2 different prisons at 2 different times. Once at Greenhaven in the mess hall, another time somewhere else. So, you know, they know he has some influence, and they're afraid he would have influence over the community, you know? They don't have the community getting all wake and waking up and stirred up again. Something might happen. Yeah, so I would really encourage people, you know, keep the heat on the governor. He needs to hear from everybody. And the governor's Twitter handle is there for people to tweet to him. I write a letter. I sit down and write a letter, then I fax it to him, and then I mail it to him. So, you know, I'm going to just keep it up because I feel like it's the right thing to do. And I think it's a very minimal thing that people can do for any of our prisoners. You know, Joel has sacrificed 46 years of his life. 46 years of his life. For us. For us.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.